Welcome. This is the January 23rd, 2023 Finance and Administration Committee meeting, and we'll now begin. I have a few announcements to make before the meeting is conducted. The meeting is being conducted in person at the Rio Vista Water Treatment Plant Boardroom. As a convenience to the public, members of the public may alternatively participate remotely by using the toll-free call-in number or Zoom webinar link provided in the committee packet, which is posted on the SCV Water website. In the event there is a disruption of service which prevents the agency from broadcasting the meeting to members of the public, this meeting will not be postponed or rescheduled, but will continue without remote participation. The remote participation option is being provided as a convenience to the public. It is not required. Members of the public are welcome to attend the meeting in person. For members of the public who are present and would like to comment, please complete this and submit a public comment card to the administrator, which is Erica, to help expedite this process. To participate in public comment from a computer, tablet, or smartphone, please click the raised hand feature in Zoom or dial 9 when I announce the agenda item on which you will wish to speak. When it's your turn to speak, please dial star 6 and to unmute. The procedures for tonight's meeting are as follows. I will introduce each agenda item. Staff will present. I will ask for public comments, first from members attending in person and those who are attending remotely. And I will then ask for discussion and questions from the committee members. These will be taken in order hands are raised. The committee then comes to a consensus to move this item to the board for consideration. And we go from there. And any PowerPoint presentations shown at tonight's meeting will be posted on the SCV Water website. And we have present tonight Board of Director Armitage and Board of Director Kutsait and myself, the chair, Ken Peterson. So we'll continue with the agenda. Item number one, the Pledge of Allegiance. Please stand. And Maria, would you lead us in the pledge, please?
Sure. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Item two is public comments.
Yes, we do have public comment this evening.
All right.
Ms. Kim Noltemeyer, you may approach. Thank you.
Kim Noltemeyer, this is just a technical question. The board is fully formed now, and therefore it would be subject to recall. I just need to know if that's true. Legally, would we be able to file a recall?
Well, if that's your choice, that can be done, yes.
Please?
Yes.
The answer is yes?
Yes.
Thank you.
No other comment at this time.
Item three, and that's will be presented by Chris Perez. Mr. Perez, you have the floor.
Okay, too many electronic devices. It'll buzz. So good evening. Finance and Administration Committee. Good evening, Chair Peterson. So today I'm presenting a request for a contract for the metered data management system. And so I have some slides I've put together to help kind of walk us through that. It's just a handful of slides and just a reiteration of what I'm going to talk about. So first slide. Thank you. So background, I realized after I sent the memo out, some folks might not know what AMI and some of the terminology I used. I might not even know that. So I did some little bit of my purpose here is to kind of give you some more background. So there's some understanding of some of these concepts that I assume some folks might have already known, but may have not. So starting off with some background of the Enquesta system. So Enquesta is our customer information system. In 2020, our board of directors adopted going forward and upgrading, consolidating all our customers into one customer service system, the Enquesta system. So that was a commitment we made about 2 years ago. It was late 2020 when that decision was made. So some folks in the committee might not have been here at that time and were part of that decision making, but that decision was made. So that was kind of our step into an enterprise solution. So as opposed to, you know, you and I kind of buying a piece of software for our computer for our own personal needs, as a new larger organization, we're now making commitments to enterprise solutions, these giant Goliath of applications, which are interconnected to many, many things. And when we commit to those things, we kind of have to commit to whatever other bells and whistles or add-ons or modules that are part of that. We can no longer just, okay, I would like to have an unrelated meter device management system that has nothing to do with Enquesta. That would require us to go out, customize, develop an application. And then that application that we customly build wouldn't necessarily fit inside of our existing Enquesta system. And this is to a point that Director Gutzeit made a couple months back, and she was asking, can we integrate some of our other things into our customer interface? For example, I think you had mentioned you're asking about our rebate system, our rebate program. And I believe Kathleen had mentioned, Kathleen Wilson, our customer service manager, mentioned to me a couple of weeks back that we are working on integrating that into that one interface. So with that said, we're kind of bought into Enquesta. It's been 2 years. We just finished up, I think it was in May of last year, we finished up the consolidation of all our customers into the one system. And then educating everyone on automated metering infrastructure. Those of us in the business call it AMI for short. Automated meter reading infrastructure is kind of the latest and greatest in meter reading technology. So AMI allows a meter to send read data from the house or the location where it's at to a strategically located tower that we as an agency put out somewhere on a water tank or some high point. So that tower collects the data from the meter, from the home directly to the tower. And then from the tower, it goes into our cloud metering system. We have two meters that we use as an agency. We use Census and we use Master Meter. So there's two systems there that are collecting data from those automatic meter reading systems. So once upon a time, you know, before we had, you know, right, if you go a decade or 20 years back, folks, we still do it still too, but people would drive around in a vehicle and they would have a radio collector and an antenna, and that would, you know, you would get in within a mile or so proximity to the meter and it would collect that data and be sucked into the system. And the person would drive their truck back to the office and they would connect that computer to the system, move the data from the computer into the system, then into the customer service system. And then if you go further back, you know, 30, 40 years, we were walking routes. So it didn't have to be a gentleman, it could be anybody, but a person would walk the route physically, clicking, typing in a read, finishing the route for that day, driving back to the office, plugging that little machine into a computer, downloading that stuff. So what we're talking about here is connecting what's called an automated meter reading system into the customer service system. And what to do that and to accomplish that task, we need a meter data management system. What a meter data management system is a clearinghouse So it's like a center cog in a machine where this customer, this meter data management system can interface and communicate with the different meter reading systems we have, as well as our customer service portal, as well as with our Inquesta billing system and with geolocation systems like ESRI GIS. So kind of just a general background of all this stuff. And I left that out in my write-up, but I wanted to make sure that everyone kind of understood all that because it's really important. And the last part I mentioned here in the background is folks that don't know, I think they might have mentioned this in other committees, but there's an amazing effort that was made by the operations folks, customer care as well, and Cheryl Fowler, our grant guru. They acquired a grant for AMI the changeout program, and they acquired the grant in September of last year, so it's September 2022. And one of the conditions of that grant is having this meter data management system set up and going and working, so customers potentially could see their near real time data and have a portal within our customer portal. So that's a big driver in us moving forward with this meter data management system. Is one of the conditions of that $2 million grant. So next slide, please. So the importance and value of what we're doing here with this meter data management system. So as you can imagine, real-time data, I say that it's able to do real-time data. So technically the meter is able to send data out every 5 minutes. That's near real-time. We likely wouldn't do that because that would eat up the battery at the meter. The meters have a life of, I think, 10 to 15 years. But if that poor battery is sending a signal at every 5 minutes, it's going to eat up in that battery. It's not going to last. Most likely it's going to be most likely it'll be sending out data probably once an hour, and then packeted. I believe it packets depending on our, you know, a bunch of decisions we'll make on the back end and the technical side of things. But that's one of the benefits. In addition to that, we'll have a system in which that leak detection and conservation can make decisions. Right now, it's an effort to get anyone out to physically interrogate a meter. You have to physically put someone in a truck. Again, a truck with the radio system in it and a computer. They drive out to the location. They interrogate the meter, bring that data back into the office, hand it off to, for example, customer care or the conservation department to now look over that data and evaluate it and make another decision to send someone out there again. So one of the humongous values of having this integration through this meter data management system is that resource deployment is totally changed. A person in the office can interrogate that meter or evaluate the data and make the conscious and decision to send someone out or physically go out to do whatever conservation work or repair work needs to be done or leak evaluation that needs to be done. So there's a huge, huge savings in regards to work efficiencies and just resource deployment. Additionally, I have listed here is geolocation of meters. So as we're moving down that course of losing institutional knowledge, we have a gentleman that's been with this organization, and his predecessors for gosh, it must be almost 40 years. And he knows every meter like it's the back of his hand. He knows every location. After time, driving your car and you pick up the meter. Sometimes you never physically go out to go look at that meter because it works fine. Then years go by, and now that meter's overgrown with grass or shrubs or whatnot. And guess who knows where that meter's located? Probably the gentleman that's about to retire. So with that, this meter data management system also connects us with our GIS system. So our GIS team is going through the process of has gone through the process of geolocating all our meters with pretty good accuracy. We use a survey grade data collecting systems, and we're within a couple inches on a bad day. So with that, having the ability now to connect that meter data, that location within another interface. Now, a person who gets hired tomorrow could take that take a tablet or an iPad and be able to navigate themselves to a meter that's overgrown or potentially could have been lost if we didn't have a relationship between our meter and its real time location. So, and then lastly, I already mentioned this. This was kind of to Director Gutzeit's question or comment a couple months ago in regards to integration with our customer interface. So moving forward in this path, using this meter data management system as part of the expansion of our current Inquesta system, it allows an integration with the already existing customer interface. That means that our customer facing interface in our Inquesta system is called Capricorn. So you log into your account and you see your consumption. Within that space, you will have the integrated near real time data, as opposed to, again, if we were to go down another path and decide not to continue, with Inquesta and their expanded modules, we'd have to develop our own custom application with their own custom developers. And it's highly likely that would not be integrated within that same portal. It would have to be another interface where someone else had to log somewhere else into and to look at that kind of data. So that's what I meant by integrated with the existing customer interface. So next slide, please. Thank you. So project cost, you'd see this in the memo. This is a breakdown of the project cost. The one thing I want to point out is the first line item there is called maintenance. And that word that looks odd there, it's an acronym, but it means software as a service. That's kind of the normal nowadays is you no longer own anything. you're renting it or leasing it. So that first line item of $127,373, that's a reoccurring line item. That's for maintenance because this data and these systems will live on someone else's servers. It's all cloud-based. It's a cloud-based solution. So it won't be physically in our machines inside our office. It's going to be hosted in the cloud, maintained, and serviced by other folks. The next item here is professional services. That's like I had mentioned, the scope of work as described and defined by our contractor SNS, which again, SNS is the Inquesta team. So that includes all the hours related to project management, engineering, database administration, and all that. Software and license is a one-time cost of kicking off this project and licensing within the Inquesta environment. And then project contingency, what that means there is 10% of that project contingency amount is truly contingency. So if we need to hire on a separate unique contractor to do some data export, those get kind of pricey. Professional services like a professional database administrator, or professional data extractor on an hourly basis, it can range from $200 to $250 an hour. So those types of technical services get expensive. So we have a little bit of contingency there. The other 8% of that remaining 18% is for internal hours. So hours that we, as our project team, which includes tech services departments that I work with, as well as customer care, Kathleen's involvement, Robert McLaughlin's involvement, all those will be hours we bill into the project. So that's what the last 8% is made up of. Next slide, please. So here's a diagram. This diagram here. It looks kind of involved, but all you gotta stare at, all you gotta look at is that center cog. It's like a wheel. If you look at the wheel, the center cog is this meter data management system. This is that data clearinghouse, so to speak, is right in the middle. And that middle piece is going to integrate with all the other pieces. So if you look around the circle there, you have what's called Census. That's one of the meters that we use, the Census meters. And if you look top of that, there's if you go clockwise, you got Census meters, you got Master Meter. That's another meter brand that we have to integrate with because we have two different meter systems. Then the next cog there, I'm sorry, the next spoke on the wheel there is Silver Blaze, AKA also known as a Capricorn. That's what our customer interface is branded as Capricorn. So that's the customer portal, customer interface. Then you keep going around the circle, You have SNS and Questa. That's the interface that our customer care agents use on a daily basis to help serve and help with our customers. And then if you keep going, there's a little magnifying glass and some graph or chart there. That's just the a system health monitoring system to make sure our systems are all working correctly. And it's monitoring and giving us data outputs on various activities within the system. And then Mateo is a weather integration with a weather-based system that gives us I believe near real-time data back into the customer service system. And then we have the lastly there, you have ESRI. That's our GIS. That's the geolocation portion of it. So as you see in the middle, that's the center cog, and all that work being done by all those professionals for that $95,000 is the cross integration of all that stuff back into one center cog, which is you can imagine it's a lot of work and a lot of specialty. So next slide. So the strategic plan Nexus, that's kind of a new addition, but just to help clarify where this connects with us as an organization, there's two areas it connects with. Area B, which is infrastructure reliability, more specifically conduct meter replacement program as one of our strategic plan areas. And then section C, which is water supply and resource sustainability. And more detailed is to evaluate infrastructure technology, AMI and AMR technologies. Next slide, please. So just I'll just mention two. I don't have it in my slides here, but so $495,000 had been budgeted within our capital tech services budget for this fiscal year. And then the remaining roughly $188,000 is to be requested in the next fiscal year. So this project is going to take between 8 to 10 months once we kick it off. The time frame gets us to completion about middle of 2024. And as I mentioned in the very beginning of this presentation, we have a grant condition of meeting that customer portal. To get our $2 million, that deadline is by, I think it's June of 2025. So we should be ahead of schedule in regarding that that grant condition. So my request is to recommend that the board of directors authorize the general manager enter into a contract with SNS and approve costs associated with the MDMS in the amount not to exceed $682,940. And I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Do we have any public comment?
No public comment at this time.
Thank you. Directors? Director Armitage?
Thank you. Thank you for your presentation and thank you for the memo. I actually think that the requirement that they included in the grant funding to have this is actually smart on their part and forward thinking, because as you mentioned, I think it's a good tool for the agency to have, but also for customers to use. And hopefully customers will use this in the future. So I imagine the communications team will be doing some great outreach on it, so people know to use that to monitor their usage and hopefully conserve water with that information. So, I feel like this is a no-brainer. The question I have is, have we budgeted for all of those separate interface components that you walked us through? Is this the last one or are there more coming? Where are we in that process of
this is the last one that we're aware of.
Okay.
The next one we need to explore, and we're not there yet, is I was talking with Kathleen today about it, is potentially, a phone application. So that potentially could be the next thing, but that would be nowhere near the work needed to accomplish this. This in itself would enable a lot of other integrations.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then the only other thing I wanted to say was I was a little surprised to read that in the memo that meter switch out is going to go through 2030. Did I read that right?
Correct. Yeah, I was speaking with Mike Alver from operations, and that's the projected. It's going to continue right now. I think in my memo I mentioned Mike's team through contractors have completed the first 5,000 within the last, gosh, it's been 8 months maybe. I forgot how when he kicked that off, but it's been going pretty quickly.
Okay.
I myself have been in operations before. I know what it takes to change out meters. So he's moving pretty well. Yeah.
Okay. No criticism. I was like, wow, I didn't realize it was going to take that long. So
it takes a while, but yeah. I think as he mentioned between 5 and 7 years. Okay. So worst case scenario, we're done by, there's a lot of variables, I guess you could throw out there, but potentially worst case scenario, 2030.
Okay. Sounds good. Thank you. Thank you for this information.
Director Gusite.
Yeah, those were actually a good starting point for a couple of my questions. Will there be capability to do both customer alerts and our alerts for if somebody's going out of range? So if you have a peak daily read, rather than requiring the customer to check it daily, have a push notification that it's gone out of a range. Is it going to have that capacity?
It's a good question. You meaning like a alert that I got an alert when I use too much energy, I get alerts saying, hey, you're going to be double your price. That's what you mean?
Well, something like that. Actually, a better example would be on your bank account, you can some banks you can preset. Like if you have a withdrawal of more than a certain amount, you get a text message. So let's say your normal, just making this up, your more normal daily use is 15 gallons of water, and you could set an alert, say, I want to know if I go over 30 gallons of water, it's going to send me a text so that I could go and figure out where my leak is, or somebody leave a hose on, like happens occasionally. Yeah. Can we see if it can do that? Because I think that would be good. And then related, I assume staff will have some ability to identify out of range usage based on all this data flying at us.
Yeah. Oh, you know what? We're lucky enough to have our customer information system experts. We have Kathleen Wilson, and mm-hmm. I believe we have also Robert online. So okay. I think Kathleen.
Yeah. Thank you. I kind of figured you needed that. Robert's on the line if we need him. Good evening. But yes, both of those features are part of the system.
Cool.
So customers will have the ability to set notifications.
Okay.
And we can certainly configure that on our end as well.
Yeah. Great. Okay. And then my standard question I want to hear about all these amazing cloud systems is we have some kind of backup, right? In case they're hacked or burst into flames or something like that.
Yeah,
tell me so there is.
There is. Yeah. Everything nowadays, because of just the world we live in, has a backup and backup systems and encryption and transport and encryption at rest. It's just normal business now.
Okay. So even though they, in all likelihood, could get hacked like anybody else, there's a safety where we won't lose the data.
Yeah. Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
I had a cybersecurity workshop. I've been going to so many cybersecurity workshops, and the world is changing so fast. Always hear about the next thing, and oh my gosh.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Okay. I want to scare anybody. So
no, I know that's probably standard now. I just want to make sure, because it is, if it's data, if we lose it, it's a problem.
Yeah. But I guess the really kind of interesting thing is because there's redundancy now, data storage. So now we have this meter data management system that we want to push forward in. So that becomes a clearinghouse of data, but the data of the meters also lives in addition to there. It also lives in the different metering systems. So the census system holds, I believe, many years of data.
Okay.
And so does the master meter data system. Yeah. So we have redundancy actually in addition to backups.
Okay. And this project, you said, will be done by about 2024, but going back to how long the meter changeouts are going to take, are we just going to roll this out by geographic area and tell people that it exists and
Well, right now, I think in my memo, I mentioned, Mike said it's, we're about halfway right now. We have about 37,000, 35,000, 8,000 AMI meters. Mm-hmm. So with that said, we're able to push out, the system. So those folks who already have AMI are ready to go could see that data. Mm-hmm. Then folks who didn't would be, not slowly, but pretty quickly changed out in the next few years. So.
Oh, so it won't go all the way till 2030?
That's just a worst case scenario. Yeah. I think it said, Mike said between 5 to 7 years, that's going to take that long. Depending, again, there's so many factors that can impact that, especially if they're able to get more grant monies for change out projects, more staffing, et cetera. There's so many things that could affect that to make it sooner, or we can have something catastrophic that makes us take it a little longer. So,
right. Okay. No, it sounds good. I'm supportive of it. And I personally would be okay with it going to consent if everybody else is.
Thank you. Only comment I would make is that, or question is there any grants in the pipeline right now for these kind of projects?
Yeah, I asked that question myself, and I was so this particular project was not included as part of that grant application, so we cannot spend part of that $2 million specifically on solving this problem. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that I'm sure since we have the grant guru, we can keep an eye out and keep monitoring that space.
Okay, very good. I think all of us are in agreement that it would be nice to have this on consent calendar.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. Okay, item 4. Recommend approval of resolution establishing a health reimbursement arrangement, HRA, with IGOE for retired employees. I do have one letter that was submitted to us today on this item, public comment. Shall I read it?
I believe the order is that it will be presented and then we'll take public comment and then discuss. So you can read it after Rochelle presents the item.
Okay, I thank you.
Yes.
Thank you for clarifying that. So with that, I guess we do the Rochelle presentation.
Okay, so at the November 15th Board of Directors meeting, the revised employee manual policy number 18 for other benefits was approved. The policy provided for two additional options for the agency's retirees when determining medical coverage in their retirement. One of those options was to establish the process to add a health reimbursement arrangement to be used for medical premium reimbursement and or eligible medical expenses for agency retirees in lieu of employer paid medical coverage through CalPERS. This item will seek approval of a resolution to establish the HRA and authorize a general manager to enter into a contract with the agency's third party administrator, IGO. At the October Finance Administration Committee meeting, one director had raised a question as to what happens with the remaining HRA funds at the end of the coverage period. Staff had said that we needed to discuss the agency options with IGO when creating the plan document, and ultimately the agency can designate what happens with unused HRA funds at the end of the coverage period. Those options include an unlimited rollover of remaining funds after the end of the coverage period, limit the rollover of remaining funds at the end of the coverage period, or unused funds are forfeited at the end of the coverage period, but it does allow for a 90-day grace period, very similar to a flexible spending account that the employees have. They have 90 days to submit receipts for the prior year. So after discussing the plan document options with IGO, very few of their clients offer unlimited rollover. Some offered a limited rollover, and a majority do not offer rollover of any unused funds. Since the majority of retiree HRA plans do not allow rollover of any funds, staff is recommending the attached plan document in your packet, it's attachment 2, And that plan document states that any remaining funds in the HRA that are unspent after the coverage period will be forfeited and returned to the agency. And then this, the recommendation is that the Finance Administration Committee recommend to the Board of Directors to approve the resolution establishing the agency's health reimbursement arrangement for agency retirees and authorize a general manager to execute the plan documents with IGO. And this concludes my report.
All right.
We do not have any other public comment at this time, but you may proceed to read what was written and sent in.
All right. We did receive this comment letter today from Elizabeth Ohms Graziano. I used to know how to pronounce it. Dear Board of Directors, Finance and Administration Committee members, my name is Elizabeth Ohms Graziano, and my husband, Chris Graziano, and I am our retirees of the Santa Clarita Valley Water Agency. I have a question regarding item number 4, recommended approval of resolution establishing a health reimbursement arrangement, HRA, with IGO for retired employees. The revised employee manual was effective January 1st, 2023, where retirees have an option to opt out of CalPERS medical insurance and choose either to enroll in the agency's health reimbursement account, HRA, or the cash in lieu option to help pay for different medical insurance and or other related medical expenses. The HRA plan and the IGO plan, or IGO, is effective March 1st, 2023. And in the plan details, it shows that the plan years begin January 1st and ends December 31st. Will the opt-out option with CalPERS be retroactive to January 1st, 2023, since the revised employee manual date was January 2023? The 2023 plan year has already started, and originally this item was scheduled for December 12, 2022, Finance Administration Committee, and December 20th, 2022 board meetings, but was somehow delayed by management. My husband and I would greatly appreciate if the effective date to opt out of CalPERS would be retroactive to January 1st, 2023. And sincerely, Elizabeth. Do we have any other additional public comment?
No other public comment at this time.
On this item. Okay, I open up the discussion with board members.
I have comments, but I'm wondering if maybe you should answer the, I feel like Ms. Patterson's the one who can answer that question. So I'll let you go first.
Well, I just think that we in these retirees ish their situation, we could go back to January because the retiree, Chris Graziano, we haven't paid for his retiree benefits. So we wouldn't want to have paid his benefits into CalPERS for January, February, and then go back and allow an HRA or the cash in lieu option. So in this particular, and we've communicated with Elizabeth, we just said that we would talk about it tonight just to make sure that it's okay since we haven't, this plan document says March 1st, but the cash in lieu option would be able to be dated back to January.
Yeah.
To Rochelle, just wanting to clarify, we have legal opinion on that. I know that our legal counsel had some opinions about the IGO answers we got. So just want to make sure we're on solid ground before we make a commitment one way or the other there.
Yes, our legal counsel, our benefits counsel, did review the plan document. They had some recommendations and all those changes were made.
As it pertains to the comment we got today, are we clear that we could do what you're proposing?
We can do it because we haven't paid a CalPERS benefit to that retiree.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you. So one question, and then I have a couple comments. So the tiers one and two seem to be differentiated by the employment date of January 1st, 2009. Can you just briefly explain that so I'm up to speed on that?
That's when the agency, I'm not sure if it was when the PEMCA, the Pension Reform Act, okay, is our date. But if you have, it was when the vesting schedule started. It was in 2009. So anyone hired prior to the vesting schedule is not part of the vesting schedule. Anyone hired after 2009 would be part of that vesting schedule, where they would have to earn years of service in order to earn a larger percentage of agency paid medical.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. So thank you for the presentation and the memo. I'm supportive of this. I'm just trying to remember the history too, and you explained some of it. But if I remember correctly, when we approved the healthcare benefit package late last year, the option that we picked, which benefited the majority of current employees, right, had the unfortunate addition of creating increased costs for the out-of-state retirees, right? That was the situation?
It's just that the out-of-state coverage, the PPO that's offered out-of-state, just the cost increased more,
right,
than they did for employees that live in our region.
Right, and significantly, like ridiculously just more.
Yeah.
Right, okay. So thank you to everybody who did the work to kind of bring this forward. And bring this option to the table. I feel like people who worked really hard for the agency and the predecessor agency should not be punished for moving out of state and have what seemed to be kind of out of touch costs to access their healthcare. So I'm glad that we're addressing this. And I feel like it also brings more flexibility, options for flexibility to the retirees as well. So I am supportive of this, and thank you for all the work that was done to bring this forward.
Director Gusak.
My only question would be that retroactive issue. I hate to ask this, but how do we know nobody else wants retroactive, and or would they be able to be in the same situation because that CalPERS bill hasn't been paid yet?
Well, if a retiree is not enrolled into a CalPERS benefit, then they would be able to go back, because our policy was January 1st of 2023. Mm-hmm. If a retiree, like there are some other out-of-state retirees, have already received the benefit through CalPERS, they would have to opt out first before they would receive the HRA or the cash in lieu.
Oh, so if they were like last year in CalPERS, they wouldn't be able to opt out retroactive to January?
No, because we've already paid for their benefit. Unless, okay, you know, we don't want to get a complication of them repaying the agency for the benefit, right, that they've already. So for January, it has already been paid. So we wouldn't retroactive it back to January for those retirees who have already received, you know, we've already paid for their January, okay, premium.
It's just this person is a new retiree, maybe? Is that why they're?
No, it's just that they can't be dual covered in CalPERS. So they're married.
Oh.
So you can't have a couple plan. He can't, and they can't be dual covered under CalPERS.
Okay.
So he's eligible for a plan. She is eligible for a plan, but they can't have the spouse coverage because they can't be dual covered.
Okay. So this is a pretty unique situation.
This is a very unique situation.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure that we weren't doing special favors that weren't being applied uniformly, but I'm fine with it then as presented with no rollover, and also fine with this going on consent.
I agree with Director Gusak that it would be on consent. Are you, Director Armitage, yeah, agree? Okay, and no rollover with that. Thank you. Item five, discuss implementing a credit card processing fee. Rochelle Patterson.
please.
Okay. So last month at the December Finance Administration Committee meeting, staff presented an analysis of the agency's bill pay options and the associated costs of each of those options, along with a survey of the agency's benchmark agencies to compare agency offerings to that of our benchmark agencies. The agency currently pays the processing fees for all methods of payments received for water bills. But at the December meeting, the committee requested that staff do some additional research regarding the possibility of customers being responsible to pay those fees. Before the committee decided on whether to recommend approval to the going to the board of directors to have customers pay paying their credit card fees, the committee had a couple of questions that required a response from general counsel as well as from the credit card processor. The committee had asked staff to see if it was legal to require customers to pay the credit card processing fee when paying their water bill, when other payment methods like pay near me or e-check would still be covered by the agency. And also, if so, what the convenience fee would be to the customer if the agency were to no longer pay for those credit card processing fees. Regarding the legal question, it is general counsel's opinion that it is not an issue if the agency decides not to cover the processing fees for credit cards, as they are there are other payment methods to choose from that would not impose a fee to the customer. It is the customer's choice to pay by credit card. Regarding the convenience fee, only the agency would receive the lower government processing rate, which we had talked in detail about. If the agency were to decide to have the customer pay the processing fee and not the agency, the customer would be charged a convenience fee. That convenience fee is either 2.95% of the transaction amount or $2.95 per transaction. If the committee were to recommend that the customer pay the credit card processing fee, a decision would need to be made on which convenience fee to charge. We call it Model A and Model B. So Model A would impose the fee of 2.95% of the transaction amount. The bill amount would have to be between $1.95 and the maximum bill amount charged is $125,000. And Model B would impose a flat per transaction fee of $2.95. The maximum transaction amount would be $1,000. So if somebody had a $2,000 bill or $1,500 bill, they'd have to do two transactions at $2.95 each. Staff prepared an analysis as shown in the staff report of average monthly transaction amounts and what the fee would be if Model A or Model B were chosen. Approximately 77% of monthly transactions fall below $100. If the agency were to choose Model A, which is the percentage approach, 77% of credit card paying customers would be charged a fee that would be $2.95 or less. And 23% would be charged a fee of more than $2.95. If the agency were to choose Model B, which is the flat amount, all credit card paying customers will be charged the same fee of $2.95 per transaction. So again, if the committee were to recommend and the board approve for customers to pay the credit card processing fee, there would need to be a few months of outreach to notify customers of the change in process. Almost 32,000 customers are signed up for the auto pay feature. And of that 32,000, approximately 44% of those transactions are paid with credit card. Those customers would need to be notified and have the opportunity to make adjustments to their default payment method. There are some customers that would not want to pay fee and will shift their payment behavior to pay by check. Staff would anticipate a higher number of return payments due to non-sufficient funds. If this happens, of course, there's an NSF fee imposed to the customer. And if their check were to pay for a disconnected service, the service would be disconnected again, which has a fee, along with additional reconnection fees. So they could have saved $2 or paid $2.95, but saved $90. So, so in summary, if the committee and ultimately the board of directors opt to have the credit card processing fees paid by the customer and not the agency, staff would need direction on which convenience fee model to implement. the model A with the fee of 2.95% of the transaction amount, or the model B with a flat per transaction fee of $2.95. And staff would also suggest a date no earlier than July of 2023 to implement the change if chosen. Staff has no recommendation, as this is a committee item to discuss, to implement a credit card processing fee, and is looking for direction. And that completes my report.
Thank you, Rochelle. Do we have any public comment?
No public comment at this time.
Okay. Director Gutzeit.
I would say I'm not in favor of charging a separate credit card processing fee. The last time we discussed this, I just feel like we're kind of alienating a certain class of customer, probably for not a huge savings. And I also actually, my personal opinion is it's a big consumer protection. I don't like having, you know, ACHs flying around, or certainly not debit cards. So I'm not in favor. If this did go through to the full board, I would be inclined to do the 295 flat charge, just because it's simpler for customers to understand rather than calculate in their head what the percentage would be. And I mean, I think that that's pretty consistent. If you look at like LA County tax payments, they have a flat fee, I want to say, I think. I'm used to seeing a flat fee for credit cards if it's done, but again, not a fan, but that is my comment on this.
Thank you. Dr. Armitage.
Thank you. I agree. I'm also not in favor of isolating credit card transaction fees as the only fee we pass off to customers. First of all, thank you for your presentation and memo too. I try to find data on the reasons why people may use credit card for paying bills, and Experian had a survey and their data showed that 42% of people use credit card for bills to earn points. But if you flip that around, that means 58% don't use them to earn points. And so we kind of speculated last time, maybe what are other reasons why people use credit cards for their bills, and probably partially for the auto pay ease of payment, which is great for the agency because that's a guaranteed payment, or perhaps for consumer protection purposes because it's easier to dispute perceived errors when you use your credit card. But, you know, one of the things we talked about that I think is a reality is a lot of people do use their credit card if they're short on funds in the month and are trying to make their budget stretch a little bit more. So I don't think we should be adding to the burden of customers who may be using their credit card because they're struggling to pay for water, which I think a lot of people see as something we all should have access to because we can't live without it. So additionally, I think we should carefully listen to staff's cautions about a potential shift in behavior, which may play out differently and may actually end up costing more money than we realize at this point. And then lastly, I was just going to say, if we are in the minority of opinion, I would say that if we do go forward with passing on transaction fees to customers, that I would do it at the time where we do a case rate study and not kind of in the middle here, because we just fairly recently changed the rate structure and I'd hate to like throw something new at the customers again and tell them, here's another charge we're going to add to your bill, particularly for the Valencia customers who had the most significant increase recently. So that's it. Thank you.
Well, my opinion, as was stated at the last meeting, was that I was not in favor of it either. Now, given that, I, from my history of dealing with customer service issues and payment processes, and I just know that it does bring on a lot of more effort from our staff when there is no ability to use a credit card on their payment, because I've seen it over the years with the various agencies I've worked for. But I've said that last time. But to, in respect to the opposite opinion that was voiced at the meeting last month, I am looking for maybe consensus from the two of you if we want to bring it to the board or not to discuss. So put you on that edge. No. out of respect for Director Colley's discussion about this. So hearing no excitement for that, we'll just put this table this for now, and we'll wait for another meeting if we have to discuss it further. So with that, we'll move on. You can.
I agree with Director Armitage that if this, if asked, if we would bring it, I would be okay with it going straight to the full board at the time that we're working on the rate case. Because it seems like then, yeah, do all the rate stuff at once. Does that make sense to staff or no? Does that not make sense to include it with that? Doesn't matter?
Doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter to you. Well, I would rather not have customers have too many things to worry about all at once. So if he asks when could we talk about it, if he wants to at the full board, I would just say do it with the rate making process.
Okay, thank you for that comment.
Yeah, I'll just say I think the question did provoke a lot of good thought and information gathering and sharing, so that we have more insight into sort of the cans and can'ts or coulds or couldn'ts if we wanted to or didn't want to. So I think it was a worthwhile venture, and I appreciate the effort that Rochelle and her staff went through to develop all that information. I do like the suggestion of maybe if we don't bring it forth, you know, soon, then I would suggest maybe we park it and consider whether we want to address it again as part of the rate study, because we might have, you know, we might have the ability to implement an option with a little more transparency and warning if we did decide to do that. And it would also give us time. I know that Dr. Armitage will probably find four more articles between now and then on different ways to do it. So I think it was a good intro course on the topic, and would be comfortable staying the course until we get to that point, for what it's worth.
Thank you, Mr. Stone. So we move on to item 5. Discuss implementing item 6. Knock that out. Continued discussion of rate pair assistant programs presented by Rochelle Patterson. Go ahead, Rochelle.
So we have just a short presentation to keep us on target here. So we go to the next slide, Erica. So this is just, we're kind of bringing back the update. February of 2022, this item was the last time that this item was discussed. It was put on hold at that time, waiting for the outcome of SB 222. And SB 222, it established a water rate assistance program and water rate assistance fund to provide water affordability assistance for drinking water and wastewater services to low income ratepayers. SB 222 did pass at the end of the session, although Governor Newsom vetoed the bill, and he vetoed the bill because there was no funding identified, that it would create an ongoing problem that would require all community water systems and wastewater systems to participate and would result in significant general fund pressures in the billions of dollars to provide such assistance. We did consult with Matt, what was the our legislative advocate for?
Oh, Dennis Albiani.
Yeah. There you go.
Sorry.
To try to get an idea of where SB 222 was, and the word on the street is that Senator Dodd is going to bring it back, but he would need to do that by February 17th of this year. But in the meantime, SEV Water is registered with a low income program. It's LEWAP. It's the low income housing water something. low income household water assistance program, LEWAP. And it is so far we have not received any payments to date from this program, although we are a participating member since April of 2022, although the program really didn't start until June or July of 2022, and still have not received any payments from this program, although the way the system currently is, it's for past due bills. And it could be possible that through the state program, when we received the rearage program, maybe some of those past due bills got paid. So since they do have a lot of funds remaining in this program, they are transitioning to just low-income ratepayers who just need help paying their bill. They don't have to be late. They don't have to be at that disconnect status. So it's possible maybe we will see some additional funds or helping some ratepayers through that program. This one is expected to expire August of 2023 unless extended. And since there are funds available, it possibly will be extended. We also offer our own payment plans. We provide an up to 12 months payment plan for people to avoid disruption of service if they sign up for that. Next slide. Okay, so just Googling, looking up everything that I could find on agencies that offer some type of ratepayer assistance program, looking for public agencies, not private companies. Three of our benchmark agencies offer some type of assistance. Cucamonga Valley Water District, LADWP, and Torrance Municipal Water. There were six others that I found, public agencies that also offer some type of ratepayer assistance, which is Crescenta Valley Water District, Roland Water District, Contra Costa Water District, Elsinore Valley Municipal Water District, East Bay Municipal Water District, and Palmdale Water District. On page 45 of the packet, there is a table that shows how much, because it does vary based on agency, how much each agency contributes to that plan, how much their monthly credit is on the bill, different eligibility requirements for depending if they use the CARE program or other kind of income eligibility programs. So it is definitely not consistent. It's a little bit all over the place. But we did try and at least gather as much information as we could, even to go so far as I contacted all of these agencies to try to figure out how much they actually budgeted for their program every year. Some information I received and some I didn't. I also did try to make it apples to apples. If it was a smaller agency like Roland Water, they have 13,000 customers. And if we have our 75,000 customers, to try to get an idea of about how much that budget would be. They budget 42,000, and I think our equivalent would be about 210,000 if it was an equivalent program. Next slide. This was just the simple estimate of assistance, some calculation. So according to the Santa Clarita Valley Economic Development Corporation for 2022, about 7.3% of our families in the Santa Clarita Valley out of a population of almost 300,000 lie below the poverty level. And if we assume 4 residents per water account, that's about 5,452 accounts that could potentially be in a low income family. So we just assumed assistance of $10 off the fixed charge. Right now, our 3/4 inch charge is about $20.85. But if we did a flat amount, almost 50% of $10 off the fixed charge, if all 5,452 accounts participated in the program, it would cost about $654,000 annually. And an alternative would be to fix the annual allocation of the program to something smaller, knowing that not all 5,452 accounts are actually responsible to pay their water bill. They fall below that poverty line, but they are in an apartment and are not responsible to pay their water bill. We would definitely see less than 5,452 customers. Next slide. So where would the funding come from? So for an agency program, non-rate revenues can be used. They're the only things that can be used. So our non-rate revenue is 1% property tax, sell, lease, rental income, even some investment earnings would be considered non-rate revenues. Currently, our non-rate revenues are used to offset the need for higher rates for all customers. Funding would ultimately reduce the PAYGO budget until new cost of service study and rates were adopted. So just as a reminder, how our rates were developed and the budget process works, we estimate our revenues from all sources, operating and non-operating. We subtract our expenses, we subtract our debt service. If we had any portion of our rate that was used to fund reserves, if applicable, which we don't have any, that would come out first. And then what's left over is available for PAYGO. So any additional program that we have, if we put any money into it, would come out of PAYGO. Next slide. So we're looking for some guidance for this program. So first, is there an interest in pursuing further development of a ratepayer assistance program? What is the desired amount of monthly assistance per account? What amount of funds would be desired or provided for the program on an annual basis? And knowing that other non-rate revenue sources would need to be identified. Or we could wait to see if new legislation is introduced, which addresses the lack of identified funding in the vetoed SB 222. Next slide. If there is interest, staff would be looking for some clear guidelines in order to develop a policy. And we are trying to, because, you know, we do have a certain number of customer care staff that already have full-time jobs. And this would take some time out of those staff in order to implement this type of program. We would ask that we use the CARE program to determine income eligibility. They can just send us their SCE bill or SoCalGas bill that says that they are eligible, they are getting the CARE rate for those accounts, and assuming it's the same account holder as the SCV water account holder, we would use that as income eligibility. We can establish a priority for seniors over the age of 62, veterans, and potentially the permanently disabled. We would ask that it be for residential individually metered accounts. And that we would want the account holders to re-qualify each year. Next slide. So the recommendation that the Finance Administration Committee review and discuss the ratepayer assistance program and provide further directions to staff. And that concludes my report.
Thank you. Very well done. Any questions from the public?
No public comment at this time.
Or comments with that? Director Armitage, go ahead.
Thank you. Okay, so
some foundational thoughts that I had, and I want to bring forward really quickly to kind of set the stage, I think, for this discussion. So you mentioned last time around, we decided to wait and see how SB 222 played out. You mentioned the legislature supported it, but the governor vetoed it because there was no specific funding source attached to it. I will say I was personally disappointed in the lack of support from Aqua on it, and that there wasn't more of an effort made collaboratively to find a funding source for it, but that's the way it played out. We were briefed in Public Outreach and Legislation Committee just last week that Senator Dodd does have a placeholder bill, SB 3, in place that has actually different language, and he's going to likely kind of flip it back to the spirit of SB 222 and put that back out. But honestly, I feel like I'm not holding my breath this time around like we did last time, and holding out hope, because last year we had a surplus and this year we have a deficit. So I don't know, if we couldn't find it in a surplus year, I don't know how we're going to find funding in a deficit year. So I am not holding out hope for that at all. You had mentioned that the LEWAP ends in August, so that kind of comes off the table as an option for ratepayers who may need assistance. Okay, so another foundational issue is, you know, I feel like our job as board members, part of it is to ensure, or a lot of it is to ensure that our customers, our neighbors, our fellow community members have clean, sustainable, and affordable water, right? I mean, that's our mission that we are reminded of each time we come into this room. And as noted in your memo, according to the Santa Clarita Economic Development, is it Commission?
Corporation,
thank you. 7.3% of families in Santa Clarita are living below the poverty level. So, and I think we all know that the housing requirements that are passed on to localities by the state are requiring and encouraging communities to build a more diverse housing stock to allow for more affordable housing in each community. So we're going to continue to see a wider range of income levels in Santa Clarita going forward. And what is affordable and reasonable to one family could be very different for another. So I understand and I appreciate seeing other water agencies taking time to give consideration on how to work with customers who are at a lower income level and may have a hard time struggling or paying for their bill. So, and then I feel like on top of that, one of our next agenda items that we're going to have a discussion about today is about how we're going to pay for and handle our, and structure our debt for really expensive capital improvement projects, which are ultimately going to come to the customers in the form of a higher bill, right? So my last foundational thought is it seems to me we don't really have a good sense on how much participation we would have from a ratepayer assistance program. And we're kind of leaning a lot of assumptions, which who knows if they're true or not. So all of that to come to my conclusion, to say that I would be in favor of piloting something to kind of test the waters to see what would the participation rate be. And then kind of after maybe, I don't know, picking a number, 3-year pilot program, kind of reassessing based on how many people participated, how much work did we have to put into it, how much did it cost us. So kind of what I envision for a pilot program would be to provide assistance to the specific group. I like the group that you kind of picked, the low income, fixed income population of seniors, permanently disabled and low income veterans. I think that's a good group to start with, you know, and maybe, I don't know, if there's less participation, maybe at some point we open it up a little bit broader from there, but I think that's a good group to begin with. You know, I would like to learn in terms of how to pay for it. I would like to learn more about the Project Angel project that LEDWP is doing, where it sounds to me like people are donating. So I don't know if we could have a line on people's payment coupons or when they pay, say, would you like to round up for Project Angel or whatever we would call our version of that? Or would you like to donate a dollar each month or whatever? And I don't know how fast a fund like that would accumulate. Somebody would have to do the math, but, you know, and if that wouldn't be a quick enough ramp up for it, you'd mentioned the cell towers. Maybe we could just on a, like a 6 month, I don't know how the contracts work. Somebody would have to help me with that, but maybe just temporarily use money from a cell tower contract just to ramp us up and then switch over to like the Project Angel model to continue paying for it. Cause I know there is some concern from some other people on the board that we don't want it to feel like it's a subsidized program, that customers who may not want to be supporting it are paying for it. So I think that would be an important component. And I think, you know, we should cap it. I'm throwing a number at $100,000, cap it at that first come first serve basis. And people would have to reapply every year. And I thought the $10 off a fixed charge sounded reasonable to me also as a place to start. So, and then using the care eligibility determination process sounds like a good thing too. So that's kind of what I'm envisioning in my mind as a pilot project. See how it goes, feel it out. If it works, great. And if it doesn't, we reassess in 3 years, whatever time period we decide to do. Thank you.
My thoughts on this, and I had asked what the legislative policy was on this, and you said it was in the report, but I didn't see it. I thought the POL committee, which I'm brand new to, didn't hear what they did last year. I thought they said the ledge committee would support ratepayer assistance if the state administered and paid for it. Is that the policy of the ledge committee, or do we know? Because I don't know.
I think, well, it's sort of the inverse. I think it was they would support a system to the extent it did not impose costs on the other ratepayers of the agency. But I'd have to go back and read the wording. But if functionally, where we got with the legislation was, and one of the two big reasons AQUA remained opposed. One, they were trying to implement through a department that has not a great track record, and they were hoping to go through the same department that's doing the other utilities for the obvious parallel reasons, as opposed to handing it over to the State Water Board, who's sort of busy.
Right.
And had been getting criticism last year for not getting their own disadvantaged community, ag community kind of programs out quickly enough. So there was concern about that. And the other was that the obvious thing is if there isn't a funding source identified, it's going to, you're going to get the thing rolling, and then it's going to default back to each local agency having to pay for it at some point. And one of the studies that was commissioned by an earlier piece of Dodd legislation really illustrated the problem with that, that if you're in a community that has a relatively high level of low income ratepayers, that's not easy to do. There isn't much, you know, there may not be any other revenue source that isn't subject to Prop 218, which is a problem in and of itself. And so really it is a, you know, because of 218, it really comes down to, I think, a general fund, you know, poverty assistance function, and whether the state would like to do that for utilities or do it in a more general sense for other services. I do like, I'll just say I like Director Armitage's thought. If there is interest in going forward, there may be a way to limit our exposure by doing it that way. And I think in that table that Rochelle provided, there were examples of agencies that did. They just basically said the enrollment will be capped after the first X number of people are enrolled, so that they could budget a firm amount. And I don't know if they rotated, you know, so others could get a chance. I guess the re-enrollment provided an opportunity, you know, for that. But my feeling is at some point this is going to be tackled by the state. But I do agree that this budget condition might not, you know, lend itself to that. And there are agencies that are, you know, kind of looking at other ways to innovate that. I think taking the scale down from $600,000 or $700,000 budget to $100,000 would be a pretty big step to make it a little more feasible for us, and to not have it look like we're, you know, essentially raising rates for some customers to pay for others, which puts us into a bit of a 218 bind. Mm-hmm. So a lot of thoughts. I liked how you laid out a comprehensive set of thoughts on it. And I think I'll stop because I probably went beyond answering your question. Sorry.
Well, yeah. And I just want to make sure that I heard the answer to the question was that Aqua was opposing it because they didn't want
really
the other customers to pay for the subsidized customers. They wanted the money to come from the state or someone else.
This goes back a ways to when there was proposals to tax water agencies, in effect, send that money to Sacramento and then either send it back for infrastructure or put it into ratepayer assistance programs, various iterations of that. And Aqua has been, I think, consistently opposed to that.
Mm-hmm.
And the study bill was kind of the result of blunting one of those efforts. And the study actually, I think, shed a lot of light on the issue. And now the question is just the political will in Sacramento to say we're going to dedicate a certain amount of general fund revenue in competition with all the other, you know, neat things that want general fund revenue. Aqua at the end just said, Dodd, you haven't identified a funding source. It never went through a committee and had that amended in. And the governor essentially said the same thing, that I'm not going to commit to a one-off because I know it will become a permanent program and there's no funding source identified.
Yeah. So. Okay. Well, I thought I remembered our Ledge committee having a position, which sounds consistent with Aqua's position.
Sorry, turn the mic off. It was a little more nuanced in that we were trying to convey our encouragement while still kind of standing with Aqua on a couple of the key bedrock points, but also saying, hey, we want you to continue to try to find a solution here.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So I have, actually, I really appreciate Director Armitage's comments. They were cast a little more potential on this for me. I am really concerned. I mean, every time we spend money on anything, it's coming out of the customer's pocket in the end. And with it coming, you know, ultimately coming out of PAYGO, that means, you know, that's money that if it's not PAYGO, it's borrowed. So then we're borrowing money and paying interest on it. You know, it's certainly not money laying around doing nothing otherwise. I know there are other community programs. Yes, there are other community programs. I know during COVID, we knew of people that were getting through their church or through other nonprofit groups to assist. So, and I'm sure, you know, people can look for those or find help with that with entities like our senior center. And what I don't want to see is our agency spending a lot of administrative time on this. That is a concern of mine. I would entertain it if the full board does with a cap. To see how it goes, I am concerned of if we do it and pull it back, that is also a bit of a mess. Although, so we might assume that whatever cap is might live forever. The pilot might become a permanent pilot like most other tax things, although some of them do ultimately expire. But pilot program would be okay, in my opinion, only with a cap. I'm not okay with the budget estimate that we have now, especially since we don't know the administrative costs for this. Lastly, I do like the following policy guidelines. So I'm going to say this. If the committee decision is to bring this to the full board for input, I do like the policy guidelines and I would like them included. One question/comment, because this happens to us.
is the eligibility account has to be in the same name as the SCV water account holder, especially with seniors. You have maybe mom set up the account, or, you know, mom can't handle it anymore, so the kid set up the account for mom because she doesn't know how to set up an account anymore. I mean, literally this happened to us. So I'm not disparaging anyone. I'm saying that happens. Could we have that be like in the same family, or have it be a, what is it called? I put legal administrator, but if you have power of attorney for that person, that it be considered the same, because I think people have accounts in all sorts of different names, including the kid names in the case of seniors, or maybe the husband's name. Maybe the husband set up the gas account and the wife set up the water account just because they were dividing duties. So I get that we're trying to, you know, avoid fraud, but if it's some legal relationship, I would support that. So I guess that's where I'm at. I really don't know. I wish the state would do it. I agree the state may not do it this year. I'm willing to try if the rest of the board wants to try. Probably not inclined to go full tilt at $10 off of every projected person right now. So, one last thing I'll add. I mean, you know, the power bills on top of our California special high gas bills are painful for everyone. And we are coming out of a very weird season where I still see private sector struggling to hire people. There's actually a quote, New York Times, people saying they made more money on unemployment and they wish they could just stay on unemployment. That was an interview in the New York Times. Which is telling. It's just messed up right now as far as who can afford what, but it's painful for everyone. And so I also want to recognize that when you realize your family's paying, you know, $500 and change in bills just for gas and electric, the water bill doesn't look so bad. So I am sensitive to increasing costs on other people.
Oh, well, thank you. I've lived with the CARE program through my administration duties at various times in this past 10 years, probably more than 10 years, actually. But I think that administration takes care of those things for you, the staff here, that they won't have to put that much time into it. It's just really just getting that the gas company, the electric company has gone through all those steps already. So
that's a good condition.
That is a good condition to have. In fact, I'm in favor of it if it was with the CARE program, since I'm very familiar with that. But I agree with both of you that we have an interesting community that has, you know, customers in our service area that may be in need of some kind of a break, a little break as it may be, but it's a break. And I've seen, you know, positive outcomes with those kind of breaks with the agencies that I've dealt with. So with that, can I get a consensus that we want to bring this to the board with the idea that we use the statements that Director Armitage has said, using the policy of CARE and then limiting it to $100,000. Want to do that?
So we can, if that's the consensus, we can work on drafting a policy and then bring it back to the committee.
And we can do that too.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
like, as our director Armitage has said, it's a pilot program. We would do it that way.
Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And one last comment, though. I, as some of you may know, I do not get my water service from the agency here. I get it from District 36, the county of LA. And I'm constantly getting emails from the county of LA of opportunities for assistance in my water bill. I mean, it's actually a monthly email, but it is not the same as the CARE program. It's a third party type of assistance. So with that, I'll move on to item our next. Yeah, go ahead.
I would like to see us see if we can, you know, actually I get notifications like that too. Mine do come from Edison, but I don't know if there's something we can do with these community resources or that other. Is there a clearinghouse for it? Or can we remind people that there's programs to help them?
Right. On the water bill, every water bill has the LEWAP program on there.
Okay. And then, I mean, I guess people are going to have to do their own research if they want to see, you know, if there's a church program or senior program. Okay. But we mentioned the LEWAP. Okay. Thank you. Sorry.
All right. Item 7. Is hopefully yes. I won't take that long.
So we have Laura Carpenter from Fieldman Roll Up, and she's going to go through a presentation that will look similar. One other little scenario for discussion, and then we will close it out with asking the question. And then maybe looking at going through the schedule, and there's a draft reimbursement resolution, and there's going to be some other legal documents coming through if the committee is in favor of moving forward with a bond issue. So take it away, Laura.
Thanks very much, Rochelle. Appreciate the introductions. And good evening, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be back before you this evening. As mentioned in the staff report, we did give this similar presentation in terms of trying to optimize the potential financing needs for the agency's large upcoming 10-year CIP program by providing different funding options. So back in October of last year, 2022, we brought before the committee four different scenarios that looked into a 10-year CIP program that was split up between PAYGO and debt-funded CIP projects. And Erica, if you could please proceed to the third slide of the presentation. This is what we had presented back in October. Again, we're looking at almost a 50-50 split of that 10-year CIP, summing to a $747 million projected through fiscal year 2032. Approximately $380 million is for debt-funded projects. The remaining is for the blue highlighted bars, the PAYGO-funded projects. Again, back in October, we provided four different scenarios of the best opportunities that the agency could use as a municipality to finance a portion of it through debt or finance or fund portions of it through PAYGO-related needs, current year revenue, or even reserves. It was brought back following that October meeting, an indication of two top scenarios that were a highlight of the best scenarios that would be funding the CIP program. Before that, though, there was a request to bring information back to the committee in connection with this CIP plan, which was done in December with the engineering staff member, Courtney, brought before the committee all of the current projects and the budgetary plans that we have shown here on the slides. And so what we wanted to do today is really bring back those top two scenarios and the reasons why we think those are the recommended approach for funding this large CIP program. So if Erica, if we can move to the slide 4 here, what I wanted to reiterate again, pursuant to the staff report, the first two scenarios that we are not showing here today, scenario 1 was really a full PAYGO scenario. How do you fund the 10-year CIP of almost $747 million solely with incoming revenue and PAYGO results? Scenario 2 was then funding the debt-funded PAYGO with only bond-funded long-term revenue funded debt. Both of those results or both of those scenarios resulted in higher anticipated rate increases, as well as a lower burden of or lower resulting reserve allocation for the agency's outstanding reserve policy. So we thought both of those through committee's review as well in October, those would not be a prudent approach to funding this large CAP program. What you see here on this slide is scenario three. Scenarios three, as well as scenario four, uses the Water Infrastructure Finance and Innovation Act to fund a large portion of the CIP. And if you recall from our prior discussions, WIFIA is funded through the Environmental Protection Agency. It is a governmental loan that allows an agency to fund up to 49% of its eligible project costs, in addition to amortizing or repaying that loan only after a substantial completion of the projects and over a 35-year term. So very attractive terms and conditions that we hope to be able to utilize. Again, the agency did send in a letter of interest for this WIFIA program. We have yet to hear back. But pursuant to receiving a letter of intent to proceed with the application, Scenario 3 and Scenario 3A assume the issuance of approximately $320 million in funding under the WIFIA loan program. In addition to that new debt, we are also contemplating a current year financing of approximately $75 million, and that is to help fund the immediate needs of CIP between now and when a WIFIA loan could be utilized or drawn upon. There's still about potentially 12 to 15 months delay in receiving a WIFIA loan if the agency were to be accepted. So taking that into account, as well as the existing agency reserves and what is remaining on the outstanding bond proceeds, it will be prudent to continue to fund those construction needs of your outstanding projects with an additional bond issuance of approximately $75 million. Under Scenario 3, assuming that $75 million bond issuance, as well as funding for the WIFIA loan transactions, you'll see on the chart shown directly on the middle portion of the screen that we're able to keep the agency's reserves at that 80% funded threshold, which we think is a prudent way to keep ongoing CIP funding needs, but also leave enough in your reserve buckets to fund any emergencies or any sort of operating needs on a year-to-year basis. The difference between Scenario 3 and 3A is the timing and impact of potential future rate increases. Scenario 3 assumes no early rate action, that the agency sticks with its current rate plan through fiscal year 2026 and then implements an additional five-year plan thereafter. Scenario 3A assumes that 1 year prior to the conclusion of the existing Prop 218 notice, the agency enters into additional rate Prop 218 notice that increases costs 1 year earlier than planned. What Scenario 3A does is it does smooth out those potential rate increases. And on the following slide, we do get into a little more details on what those potential rate increases might look like. But in comparison to the reserve levels, Scenario 3A, you see in the percent funded line, that blue line, the very bottom of the screen, we are showing slightly higher reserve levels by going with Scenario 3A. Next slide, please. Here gives a representation of, again, the two scenarios we're discussing today, Scenario 3 and Scenario 3A. What it looks like for actual rate increase, annual rate increases as a percentage versus the potential monthly impact to a customer bill. From Scenario 3, which does not assume any early rate action, we've anticipated an 11% potential need of rate increases in fiscal year 2027, as shown in the bar graph below your screen here on this slide, then jumping down to 7% and 4% thereafter. Scenario 3A does smooth out those level of increases starting 1 year earlier in fiscal year 2026 and 9%, then drops back down to 8, 7, and 4% thereafter. What does that mean in connection with potential monthly charges or monthly changes to a customer bill? Is in Scenario 3, if you revert your eyes to the very top table, instead of having the highest monthly change occur at $7, almost $8 in fiscal year 2027, Scenario 3A does drop that maximum increase to a $6 monthly change 1 year earlier in fiscal year 2026. We're also able to slightly reduce the total average annual rate increase from 6.2% down to 6.1% in Scenario 3A. Next slide, please. The next question asked, it might be, what is the level of potential debt increase from assuming this type of scenario where we're including a $75 million upfront bond issuance, as well as almost $320 million of additional funding needs through the WIFIA program over the course of this 10-year forecast. We do see that the level of debt service costs, as shown on the bar graphs shown in blue, does increase from the current level of approximately $33 million to a high of almost $43 million starting in fiscal year 2029. But you do see that that level of increase doesn't occur for another 8 or so years. And that's a pure, and that is a result of the terms and conditions that the WIFIA program does provide to its borrowers, where the agency is able to push out its repayment of large portions of its debt after completion of its 10-year CIP program, or at least the projects that you're utilizing funding from the WIFIA program. In addition, another very key term and conditions of the WIFIA program is a borrower is able to repay their debt at any time. So as you see, we do show the par outstanding on the orange line does increase to levels of $540, $560 million once the full burden of the WIFIA loan is drawn upon. But at any time, if the agency has prudent levels of reserves and has enough funding that it needs and can prepay the loan, you're able to reduce the amount outstanding on the WIFIA loan and again, save additional interest costs at least once a year, every year with no prepayment penalty. In connection with the actual resulting coverage ratios, the level of revenue that can cover potential future debt service costs, both scenarios 3 and 3A, we think produces very prudent and attractive coverage level ratios in line with the district's current credit ratings. And the coverage level ratios have slightly higher number in fiscal year 2026 for 3A, again, because you're assuming 1 year earlier rate increase, but then following fiscal year 2026, very modest to very similar coverage ratios for each scenario. Next slide, please. What we wanted to show here is, again, the reason why we're bringing forward the proposed scenario 3 or 3A to the committee with the WIFIA loan financings is because of the beneficial terms the WIFIA program can provide. As I mentioned, the financing scenarios do assume approximately $320 million of additional debt. If we compare that additional debt need with a WIFIA financing term at rates as of December 27th, which is 4%, that rate compared to a long-term 30-year bond issuance, again, based on market conditions as of December 27th, would have been 4.22%. So you receive a benefit on the interest cost by going through a WIFIA loan, and you also receive a benefit of pushing out the repayment additional 5 years and not starting the repayment until fiscal year 2029. So the comparison of those two potential new money debt issuances between a long-term fixed rate debt or a WIFIA loan financing is shown in that gray colored chart here on the graph before the slide. The blue highlighted line represents the debt service payments for you to proceed with the WIFIA loan. The gray highlighted chart represents the item or the debt service costs for you to proceed with a bond issuance in the public markets. So those estimated savings, again, you can see it's pushing out the repayment and extending the repayment long-term. For a $320 million bond issuance could estimate around $42 million savings in net present value basis. So we think the WIFIA program is a very influential, very prudent way to get attractive, low interest cost financing for the type of program and CIP funding the agency needs. The other scenario that was discussed in October was scenario 4. That also assumes WIFIA funding for future CIP needs, but it reduces the bond issuance upcoming for fiscal year 23 from $75 million to $65 million. That $65 million, again, it's a $15 million drop. So what that scenario assumed is the agency would utilize reserves rather than funding through a bond issuance. We did look at that scenario again in October, and it produced less than 80% of reserve funded per the policy on an annual basis, almost dropping to 70% by fiscal year 26-27. We do think that's the scenario we provided to you today in this presentation, where we increase the bond issuance to $75 million, is the more appropriate, more prudent way to get the funding needs for the agency's long-term CIP plan. So the request for today, again, is to look at the get direction from the committee on the type of future bond issuance to pursue, that the WIFIA loan financing is, again, a high priority for the agency, hoping that we can get that funding result from the EPA shortly and whether or not we can proceed with negotiating a loan with EPA, but get started in the meantime through this waiting time as we wait to negotiate a loan with the EPA, if approved, to start proceeding down the line of a long-term bond issuance. And to do so, what the agency can do is execute a reimbursement resolution. So in the case of needing to draw down any construction funds, any project funds, soft costs, engineering costs, you can then reimburse yourself through such long-term bond issuance going forward. So I think I'll stop here. We can proceed to the next slide, which is our recommendation slide. And I'll pass it off to Rochelle. I know she has some items she wanted to get further direction on. So I'll pass it off to Rochelle and then open it up for questions thereafter.
All right. Thank you, Laura. So I just wanted to just kind of go back just a couple steps ago where we had the scenarios. In every scenario that we showed, we needed an upfront bond issue. So we knew that we were going to be about out of our existing bond proceeds in March of this year. So we either stopped construction at all. Courtney went through the presentation on December 6th of all the capital projects. A lot of them are already in contract. They're already in construction, which would mean stopping, or we would have to, take $75 million out of our reserves in order to continue with that plan until hopefully we were invited to apply for the WIFIA, and the WIFIA would kick in about 18 months. So in each of the scenarios, we required an upfront bond issue. So that being said, we are asking if we should proceed with scenario 3 or 3A, which would mean 3 is staying with our existing rate plan where we go out our 5 years and then we start over, or 3A, go out 1 year sooner to do a new rate study to kind of smooth that those increases a bit. We also, if we get a consensus tonight, we would like to start the underwriting RFP process because that takes about 3 weeks. And then in February at our next committee meeting, we'll be going through some other legal documents. And then in March, it will go to the board and to the JPIA for approval of those documents. So that concludes our report. I think I'll let you discuss it and then ask the question.
Thank you, Rochelle, and our presenter tonight. Do we have any public comment?
We do not have any public comment at this time.
Director Gutzeit, start off.
Okay. Did I miss where we dropped number 4 from discussion? Because I thought it said we were looking at 3 and 4, and now it's 3 and 3A and 4.
Only because scenario 4, it was the same, had the same upfront bond issue and WIFIA financing, but it was taking $15 million from reserves, and it dropped our reserves below that 80%. That 80% line. And next month, when we come back with our revised debt management policy, which was drafted months ago, if our reserves fell below 80%, that's what would trigger a bond issue. So that is, we felt it was, we could still go back with scenario 4 and take funds out of reserves, the $15 million, or only go to a bond issue for $60 million instead of $75 million. Mm-hmm. But just based on the reserve levels, 3 or 3A seemed a little bit more attractive.
Okay, so do I understand that you're saying the board or this committee previously decided they were not going to go below 80% on reserves?
Well, that is what was presented in the revised debt management policy, which hasn't been drafted. It hasn't been adopted yet.
Is there any input? So I'm again feeling Dan Mortensen talking here. Obviously, if we pay some of it with reserves, we save on interest, theoretically, because the borrowing costs are going to be more than we're earning. Do we have a feel for that
spread?
So we did, we built that in because we will still need to recover that $15 million from customers at some point over the next 10 years. So that is it. The rate increases were higher. And that's why another reason why it wasn't as attractive, because the rate increases were a little bit, they weren't as high a percentage increase each year by not taking the $15 million out.
Okay. So we smooth the rate increases, or it's not as steep if we stay away from four. Okay.
Yeah. I think your question about spreads was intriguing, because it seems like right now, you know, a 4-week T-bill is like 4.4%. And that's sort of like the yield curve is hanging out around 1 to 2 years is sort of the sweet spot. Mm-hmm. So if we're holding that money and investing it even in treasuries, I would assume we're yielding interest that might not be that far off from what we'd be paying if we went out and borrowed the same money. I'm not sure if that's what your question is trying to get at.
It is, because that means, I mean, I know borrowing costs have gone up, because I remember when it was like the 2% when we talked about this before.
Yeah.
But it sounds like, just ballpark, by keeping that money in reserves, we avoid bringing the reserves down below a desired level. We avoid steeper potential rate increases, and it shouldn't be all that much off, because that we can invest those reserve funds and get money back similar to the borrowing cost of borrowing that $15,000 extra.
Yeah, I'm not going to answer that confidently, mm-hmm. but we do have our FA on the line.
Well, maybe she can answer that.
Laura may want to opine.
Am I saying that correctly?
If the engineer did good math or not.
That's a great question. So in terms of potential investment earnings, you are correct, Mr. Stone, that current 1 year to 6 months, 6 month, 3 month treasuries are ranging from 4.5 to 4.6%. In addition, the Federal Reserve is contemplating a 0.25 basis point increase in the short term rates for the federal funds. Usually that will reflect in also higher municipal market index curves and U.S. Treasury rates thereafter. There's not a direct correlation, but as we have seen from prior Federal Reserve actions last year, that increasing this federal funds target range usually results in slight increases to those underlying U.S. Treasury curves, as well as municipal market index. So while that investment strategy is a very prudent way to invest your funds, the opposite is also true, that the yield curve currently is inverted. You can invest high in the short end and also borrow at a fairly historically attractive rate in the long run. AA rated entities, today's market is ranging anywhere from 4.15% to 4.3%. So the current short-term investment might still be higher than your long-term investment needs, long-term borrower needs for a $75 million bond issuance. I also want to iterate that investing bond proceeds, you will unfortunately be capped at that arbitrage yield limit unless you are able to spend those funds within a 24-month period. But for your operating reserves, as long as you're meeting your investment policies and California code, you can invest any of your operating funds at those higher index levels for U.S. Treasuries.
Okay, but
I'm assuming Courtney's ready to spend that within 24 months.
Well, and I wasn't really talking about investing the bond funds, although that is interesting. I was talking about Dan's thing in the past was always, what are we earning on the reserves?
Yeah.
So you answer that, and then I'm inclined to like 3A, just because I feel that less shock to our customers is important. I'll just throw that out there. 3 or 3A looks okay to me, and I'd be okay. Yeah, I would be happy with the board, picking either one of them. And then lastly, what happened? We keep talking about the WIFIA being great. What if we don't get it? Then what happens?
Right. So then we're back to traditional bond issues or much early rate actions with a higher percentage increase for customer bills in order to try to collect more for PAYGO.
Okay. So if it doesn't
go through, then you're going to come back to us and we'll have to
so that's have a different plan. Like scenario two.
Okay.
So that's traditional bond issues. That's what we've been doing all along, every year, every 3 years. If we did not receive the notice to apply for WIFIA.
And Rochelle, is the difference between 3 and 3A just the timing of the next rate action?
Yes.
So in effect, if you adopt 3A or you adopt 3, the board still has, you know, its hands are not tied. You could come back and decide for a variety of reasons. There are other reasons that she may want to address this sooner. One is if you want to incorporate any changes in your, you know, affordability program, or that would be the tail wagging the dog. But the credit card, I mean, it would be the tail wagging the dog. But there are other things. We've experienced much higher than anticipated inflation during this rate case. We've been able to absorb that with some of the savings that we've been receiving. There may be other mitigating factors. We have an outstanding judgment for a considerable amount of money that if we prevail on appeal, that may take a little pressure off. So I wouldn't say you're completely locked in, but this helps us plan the next steps and keep this moving so we don't come up short and have to stop work that's in progress.
Plan. Again, I would support 3A and I support bringing it to the board and with three as the backup plan. That's it.
Thank you. Director Allen-Charles?
Thank you. And first of all, thank you for your presentation, Ms. Carpenter. It was a pleasure listening to you present again. Just generally, as a ratepayer also, I think we're all ratepayers up here, but as a ratepayer, seeing the proposed rise so significantly in these scenarios is not pleasing. But the reality is infrastructure costs money and capital improvement projects cost money. So, you know, I agree. I think scenario 3A seems, based on what's presented to us, the least painful option and most sensible, assuming we do get the WIFIA loan. So I'm on kind of the same page. Thank you.
Well, I agree with both of you about the scenario 3A. It probably is the more appropriate with the backup of 3. I really do commend our financial experts, including Rochelle, on working through all this analysis and bringing it back to the committee with a little bit of a tweaking of a scenario, which works well, too. So with that as a consent item, or is it going to be a full discussion with the board?
So the plan is, since the full board hasn't seen the scenarios and all the work that you guys have been doing, we have an item on February 7th to just at the board meeting to review our financing plan. So at that time, we will go through, you know, briefly the scenarios that we talked about, what the impacts were, how we landed on one scenario versus another, and kind of get the nod so we can, you know, continue with a financing plan and bring forward all the documents in February and March.
Do we have to do all the documents not on consent because of, like, no, it won't be on consent either time?
No.
Okay. No. Yeah, that's what I thought.
I don't think I ever saw it on consent before either myself. So, thank you all for that presentation and the discussion. With that, we'll move on to item 8, recommend receiving filing of the October 22 financial report.
Yes.
And we actually have two financial reports.
Yeah, we do. So I'm just briefly going to go through October since it's a little bit older news than the November statement that's in there.
Mm-hmm.
So for October, revenues are about $7.2 million under budget, primarily due to conservation efforts. Our expenses were $8.2 million under budget. So our net operating change was about $948,000. We were under budget in all but one department. The year-to-date for water quality treatment and maintenance was only about $149,000 over budget. We attribute that to some timing and invoices, and also our two solar fields are not quite at 100%. They're running about 80%. They're waiting for some inverter parts. So we weren't seeing quite as many solar offsets as we anticipated. And that's what I have for October, unless anyone else has any additional comments about the other components of October.
Do we have any comments from the public?
No public comment at this time.
Thank you. We'll move on.
No. So for November, for our year to date through November, our revenue was about $8.36 million under budget. Our expenses were about $9.35 million under budget for a net change in our operating of $985,000. Again, our year to date, all of our departments were under budget except for that same department, water quality treatment and maintenance, for those same reasons. A couple of things. We do in our 3-month cash flow, we have January, February, March. We are paying about $3.3 million of our interest payments of debt in January. We have also on page 105, there is a line item for U.S. Bank cash with fiscal agent. And that's the amount that we are have invested with our and managed by our investment advisor. So right now in November, it shows about $20 million, but in January, we expect it to be about $75 million. So they'll be hopefully getting us some those higher returns that we're anticipating. And that is all that I have for November.
Do we have any public comment?
No public comment at this time.
Okay, item 10 is our committee planning calendar. It gets longer every day.
I was just going to mention just a couple things. We are very close to, we'll be presenting the Valencia retail capacity fee to the committee in February. Looking to have a stakeholder group sometime the week of February 21st. Our ratepayer advocate has the report. We've been chatting along with the consultant. We are just about on the same page for everything. The calculations are very close, so there should not be any surprises there. We'll be bringing back the revised debt management policy. And then we'll also be reviewing the budget calendar and going through our mid-year budget review. It's the second quarter, December, but it would also be like the mid-year budget review. So that'll be a big meeting in February. That's pretty much all I have for the calendar.
Okay. Public comment?
No public comment.
Director Almatrage.
Yeah, just quick question. Are we going to be hearing directly from the new ratepayer advocate who we haven't had a chance to meet yet?
Yes, they will both be presenting in February at the committee meeting.
Great, thank you.
I have no other comment. So item 11, requests for future agenda items. Rochelle, you have any requests?
I don't.
That's your
request.
All right. Do we have any public comment about this item?
No public comment.
All right. Any comments from the board members?
No, I think our agendas are long enough right now.
Item 12 is a general report on finance and administration activities. So
I do have just a couple things. I did say that I would report on our accounts receivable after kind of most of the COVID period, after all the arrearage credits. We're running about $770,000 in our accounts receivable. We ran about $350,000 prior to COVID. So we're still not back to where we were, but still better than where we were during COVID. We also have a couple little statistics for how many overdue notices that we send out. And then Kathleen and her group are really great about sending out the robocalls, even though nobody may like all the robocalls, but it's become very effective in just reminding customers to, you know, call in and pay their bill. So we average about 758 shutoffs per our notices per week that go out for those overdue notices. But a few days before the bill is due, it averages about 238 of customers that are still eligible to be turned off. And then after that robocall, we're averaging about 67 actual shutoffs. So the outreach is working. And then I had one small presentation. It's not quite the maintenance moment, but it's close. So in our finance administration department, we have buildings and grounds or facilities. This is just one item that has come up that we just thought that we could show the work that the buildings and grounds crew is managing. And this has to do with the solar farm erosion here at the Rio Vista treatment plant. And this is for the lower field. That's the one that's here. It's not on the upper mesa, but it's the one down here. And it was constructed in 2011. So next slide. So if you can kind of see these pictures, you can see some of that erosion that's happening. You know, the potential causes are the soil maybe have not been compacted properly. The terrain may have not been graded properly. There's lack of wall containment, which means the water's coming, the wall's not stopping the water, it's coming through the solar farm. And the water is not draining properly. So it's causing all of these erosion issues, which could potentially lead to some failures of those holes that are holding up the solar panels. Next slide. A couple more pictures. About 80% of the field has some type of erosion issues. There's exposure to the footings for the solar panel poles. And we could have potentially have some failures due to that unstable soil. Next slide. Just a couple more pictures, and you can see some of the crevices that are and the erosion throughout the field. Next slide. We have a road up there too. It's constantly muddy, has water runoff. And then it could have a potential to block access to the antenna and the tank if that continues to happen. So part of the remediation for this will be to try to fix some of the, have that wall containment. Next slide. So here is the proposed work kind of in colors. We have a phase one that's in yellow, that's grading swales and recompaction on the north side. And then phase two, the south block wall. And the phase three is the north block wall. Next slide. And this is just the aerial of the proposed work. So that's the entire solar field. So this is where the facilities supervisor is managing this project. And we have we do have a quote. It is within the general manager's purchasing authority. We are looking for a couple more. But we just wanted to kind of, showcase some of the work we're doing and the collaboration with the sustainability manager at the same time with the other departments. And that concludes my report.
Thank you. Thank you, Rochelle. Mm-hmm. Any public comment?
No public comment at this time.
Directors, Director Armitage.
Thank you. Thank you for the presentation. That was interesting. So a couple of things. Who did the work originally? And is there any way that we could get compensated for having to redo the work? And is this something that can go to insurance?
I'm not sure about the insurance question. Other than it being less than $100,000, it may cost us more in the long run if we might have some adverse effects if we try to send it to insurance. Plus, it's not an event that just happened. It's been eroding over time. And who put it in originally? But it was originally leased and repurchased the solar panels a couple years ago.
I think it was installed by SunPower and their contractors. I'd be curious to look at it. And I saw Ken making engineers forehead squints at that, trying to figure out what the mechanism really is there, whether it's just high volume rain at times coming off the tilted panels, and maybe like it does, if you've ever had a house without rain gutters along the roof drip line, you'll start to get a little version of that. Obviously this is a little more extreme. And it may be that the soil wasn't compacted well. But I think some of the fixes might involve looking at the compaction level or even some kind of soil amendment to prevent it from continuing to happen, which happens with this kind of soil. Sometimes once it's disturbed, it wants to move. But I don't want to engineer it from a slide, so I could stay out of it. But when we get a fix, we might want to make sure we're fixing the right thing. And I'm sure our new building and grounds supervisor is, you know, pretty astute and on the ball and looking at options. So it is interesting.
Go ahead, Director Kuzan.
And General Manager Stone pretty much stole my comment. That was going to be my question/comment. You have a preliminary budget of $100,000, but that looks pretty bad. And so I would think that we would, number one, want to have somebody that deals with stormwater flow. There's a lot of possibilities on how to fix things, whether it be swales or whatever. And that would be the, we probably have somebody that works with construction general stormwater permit stuff from other construction projects where they design the proper fixes, whether it be the wattles or slope. I don't want to spend money on something that wasn't blessed as the proper way to fix it, because you can fix it, install stuff and make it worse is what I'm trying to say. So I hope we have somebody look at it that deals with that regularly. And then I also hope we have a maintenance plan, because that does look pretty bad. So I know a lot of places will go out and put wattles in every year before the rainy season. They have to be straight and all that other stuff. So maybe we need to build that into the future.
Yeah, and part of that could be the handoff from when we acquired it. The level of maintenance might not have been optimum prior to that time. So
it doesn't run out a while.
Yeah, good.
Us engineers love to develop solutions. Thank you for that. Yes, it's it probably needs a little bit more study on it to see what to do with it in the future. But there has got to be some protection being done right now to protect those foundations, even be just bringing some soil back in and just compacting it. But I was originally thinking that it might be a cause just recent storms, but I guess it has been going on for some time. That's what my impression is from you. Okay. So it's not a FEMA project, if you want to say.
I think these pictures were taken prior to the last storms we
had. Oh, okay. Yes. Well, which brings kind of an interesting topic is, did we have any facilities that were actual damaged by the rains recently?
Not that I know of.
No.
No, just our old friend Turbidity in Castaic Lake.
Oh, yes.
They're so far managing. So demands are low. So
yeah,
that helps. But it's not only turbidity, it's like logidity. There's like floating logs and things in the lake. So they can't get the boat. MWD has a boat that they take out and they do samples at the different levels of the outlet tower to try to help determine the optimum gates to open up, you know, where the most clear water is. And last week they couldn't get their boat out there to the tower. It wasn't safe because there was so much floating debris that would get caught in the propulsion system. So we're hoping this week, but yeah, it was a doozy though, some of those storms. So
I never seen that much debris. That's what happens when it doesn't rain a whole lot in the last few years.
Right. With demand down, it's not as big of a problem as the September challenge that we got through, just because we were able to basically take the plant offline. We filled up storage and took it offline during the brunt of it in the early part. But it's still an ongoing, you know, it's far from being where you would comfortably operate. There's a lot of active operational measures taking place in order to deal with it. So hopefully it'll clear up before we get a real hot spill.
No, good. Thank you, Mr. Stone. With that, we're at item number 13, which is adjournment. Thank you.
Thank you.